wants to report ICE, more information is available at CIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at CHIRLA.org.
Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, as Americans are getting ready to mark the Thanksgiving holiday, a celebration built on the foundations of settler colonialism, we'll hear from Dina Gillio-Whitaker, a lecturer of American Indian Studies at Cal State University, San Marcos. We'll discuss her new book, Who Gets to Be Indian? Ethnic Fraud and Other Difficult Conversations about Native American Identity. Then we'll take a deep dive into prison rehabilitation with my regular correspondent, Dortel Williams. Dortel is serving a life sentence in California without parole, and he'll analyze what prison rehab is, why it doesn't work, what does work, and how it can be implemented. He's also garnering supporters to urge California Governor Gavin Newsom to commute his sentence. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. In August 2022, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences apologized to Sasheen Littlefeather for her mistreatment after her 1973 protest speech at the Oscars. Littlefeather shot to fame when Academy Award winner Marlon Brando asked her to decline his award on his behalf. She read a speech at the Oscars about Hollywood's discrimination against Indigenous people and was booed off stage and blacklisted ever since. But just days after receiving the Academy's long overdue apology, a shocking revelation about Littlefeather raised the fraught question of Indigenous American identity. She was outed as an ethnic fraudster and was revealed to not be who she said she was. The case sparked a new book by my guest, Dina Gillio-Whitaker, with the Colville Confederated Tribes. She's a lecturer of American Indian Studies at Cal State University, San Marcos, and an independent consultant and educator in environmental justice policy planning. She's an award-winning journalist as well and contributes to numerous online outlets, including Indian Country Today and the LA Times. She's written multiple books, including As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock. She joins me to discuss her new book, Who Gets to Be Indian? Ethnic Fraud and Other Difficult Conversations About Native American Identity. Welcome to the program, Dina.
Thank you, Sonali. Great to be with you again.
Thank you so much for joining us. I remember being horribly shocked as well when the revelations about Sasheen Littlefeather came out. I was at that time writing a book about narratives, and had actually written a whole section in my book about her putting forward a narrative about racial identity, ethnic identity, and Native Americanness, and had to quickly go back and kind of rewrite some aspects of it. And I also remember you on Facebook, we're Facebook friends, talking about it. You had a little bit of insight before the rest of the world knew what had really happened with Sachin Littlefeather. Take us through that. You knew before most people did that she actually wasn't who she said she was. And that was because you yourself had been fascinated by her story. So tell us about that.
Right. Well, this is really the point of origin for this book. I mean, it's something I've been thinking about all my life because of my own complex identity issues. But the book started as a result of my relationship with Sachin Littlefeather, which began in 2012 when I was writing for Indian Country Today. And I had gotten to know her. I was asked to write a story about her. Had to do with a Dennis Miller comment about her, a racial slur. And so it led to my writing this article about that and meeting her. After I wrote that article, she asked me if I would be willing to ghostwrite her memoir. She wanted to write this memoir. This is about a couple years later. And I said, sure, you know, let's explore that. So it led to this whole experience that I had with her, where we began the process of writing this book together. And we never actually got past the proposal stage. She had a literary agent lined up and everything. And so we were working with him. And so during this process, I had gotten to know her more. I went up to the Bay Area, spent some time with her, interviewed her in depth on a beginning basis, and so that took place over a few days. And she also gave me the 200 pages of handwritten journal. Photocopied. And so she just handed this thing over to me. So I had this incredible document. And then she disappeared. And it was very bizarre. I don't know what happened. I didn't know what happened at the time. And to this day, I'll never know. But she just simply went MIA, called me a few weeks later and left me with the conversation that was no more than 5 minutes and said, I've decided to go in a different direction. And that was it. No, I'm sorry. Can I help cover your expenses? Nothing like that. She completely just dismissed me. But she also didn't ask for this journal back. And so it's been in my possession ever since. So it's been, that was 2015, I think. And I've had this thing in my possession. I read every single word. I categorized all the pages. So I have been sitting on this thing for years, not knowing what to do with it, but knowing that at some point, I'm going to have to do something with it. And it was partially having that thing in my possession and then just having conversations with other people and coming to this slow realization that she indeed was not who she said she was. And it was something that a lot of people had secretly known, especially in the Bay Area, where she lived. And it was a slow burn for me. But once I was able to accept that this was truly the case, that she was a fraud, then I had to do something about that. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how this book came about. So it took several years.
And so I'm wondering if you can share for our audience why you think she did what she did, to start to get at the heart of what this allure is for non-Indigenous people, people who have absolutely no heritage that they can trace back to Indigenous people, to put on this mantle. The story that you tell very much links up to the film industry and to Southern California, as you write, that basically the issue of identity, especially Native American identity, became commoditized and allowed people to simply cosplay or just, you know, adopt this as a sheen. But why would somebody do that? And what does that say about our culture?
Well, I think that there's a multi-layered answer to that question. There are a bunch of reasons. And so I guess I would begin by, so in the book, I lay out like a historical sort of trajectory. And the book itself is, the intention of the book is to create an analysis of how we get this problem, like a historically based and, you know, a socio-political analysis of this. And so you have to, so that, like, the question is, like, how did we get here? And the way that it looks to me and all the research that I've done over the years, as an American Indian Studies scholar and researcher, knowing the history the way that I do, I think historically. So when I look back at the history of federal Indian policy in this country, which up until the 20th century was about elimination, essentially, was about dealing with this ongoing American Indian problem, the way they used to call it, the Indian problem. And in the late 19th century, the form that took was a law called the Dawes Act. And the Dawes Act was about forceful assimilation of Native peoples into the American system, stripping them of their culture, their languages, all these kind of histories that are a little bit more well known today. Part of that was, you know, the boarding school issue, the funneling of children into these boarding schools that would accomplish that work of stripping culture from kids and make them grow up, you know, force conversion to Christianity, this forced cultural assimilation. And so part of that era was the Wild West shows, these spectacles of the Wild West, like the Buffalo Bill, the Wild West shows. But he wasn't the only one. There was a number of these Wild West shows that would tour the U.S. and Europe. So they would go all over the world with the spectacle of Native American defeat, how the West was won. And so this was during the time when the federal government was breaking up lands, like the land allotment process forcing people onto reservations. And it was very, very, very oppressive. And it was as much about forcing Indians, not just culturally into the American system, but economically. So that's one of the interventions that the book makes, is that assimilation was not just about cultural assimilation, it was about economic assimilation and forcing them into capitalism. And so what the Wild West shows did was offer Native people who are being brutally oppressed an opportunity to make money, because the salaries for these jobs, these performance jobs, were pretty good, especially compared to the farming and ranching that was being forced on them in the reservation communities. But it was also a time when their religions were being suppressed through the Indian Crimes Code, also called the Religious Crimes Code, where Native religions were banned. So they could join these shows, dress in their traditional dress, sort of perform Indianness in ways that they weren't allowed to otherwise, and get paid to do it. Like, it's not a bad deal, but these were always real Native people that were doing these jobs. Well, it coincides with the beginning of the film industry. So the film, in the early film industry, actually grows out of these Wild West shows. And so the early films had Native themes that, you know, were always about the lamentation, lamenting the dying Indian. Indians were at this time said to be the vanishing race. And so many of these films took on that mantle. Many of those films actually use native actors, and most of those actors came out of those Wild West shows. But in time, and it didn't take much time, now that you could make money as an actor, or even a film producer or director, you can make money doing that. It opens up this field where anybody who can perform Indianness is fair game. Like you can just, if you can put on a good performance, a good show, and be convincing, now it opens up this entire field for fraud of all kinds. And so we actually do see that in the beginning of the film industry, beginning in 1906.
And so it sort of encourages the putting it on as a mantle. Also, you write in your book, Who Gets to Be Indian, about how the very fracturing of Indian Native American communities, the fracturing of families, the ripping apart of families into boarding schools, has also made this such a complicated thing to navigate, because people were, stripped of their culture, literally stripped of their culture. And many folks, of course, deeply traumatized by it. And you write about your own personal story. Maybe this would be a good time, actually, to take that dive into how your own grappling with your identity has led you to study this issue. And also, you write about it in your book, because you can't really separate it, right, from the topic that you write about. And so tell us about your own story.
Yeah, so my story is, like, in a nutshell, it's about being raised in a Native family. My mother was Native. She was an enrolled member of the Colville Confederated Tribes, which is in Washington State, and that's where she grew up. She grew up around her culture. But at a time, in the early 20th century, when Native people had been so abused, and her mother had been boarding school. My mother did not go to the boarding school, but her mother did, and my uncles, who were my grandmother's brothers, were all sent away to a boarding school. And so I have I grew up with the legacy of that, the legacy of abuse and trauma. And that's what I knew about my lived experience of being Native, was really one shaped by all this trauma. And by the time I was born in the 1950s, this was during the termination era, and this is the sort of like the revamping of the assimilation era. It was when the federal government was forcing, again, trying to find this resolution to the Indian problem. And the way that they did this was through a plan to terminate tribes as legal entities and Indians as legal people. And they had this relocation program. And the relocation program sent Indians from reservations all over the country into big cities to disguise as a jobs program, but it was really about emptying the lands to try to get the lands back. And so it was during this era that my mother left Washington and came to Los Angeles and met my father. My father was 100% Sicilian, but they met, they fell in love, and had three kids together. And I was the first of those kids. And so I grew up in Los Angeles in this era when LA was one of the biggest populations of relocated Native people. And so it's in this environment that I was raised in this time and place. And so so it's also coincides with this, as I write about in the book, with the proliferation of, because not long after that, and since late 1950s, early 1960s, there's this is a inflection point where there are these social changes. We have the civil rights movement. We also have the ethnic nationalist movements, the ethnic pride movements that are happening. And so prior to this, though, Native people are like hated, they've been reviled. They're uncivilized savages. They are to be done away with. There's nothing admirable about these cultures at all on a large scale. But with the ethnic pride movements, all of that starts to change. And then it also coincides with changes in census rules. In 1960, Now, when the federal government does the census, they allow people to self-identify rather than to ascribe a racial identity to the people that they're interviewing. And so this is when we start to see people taking on new identities or like claiming, self-proclaiming themselves as, in this case, Native American. So it really ramps up from 1960 to 1970, 1980, and so on. And you start to see a exponential rise in the number of people claiming to be Native American. And of course, there's absolutely no, no processes for accountability or transparency. And it also, so it's also part of like the counterculture movement in California. The counterculture movement is, taking the country by storm. And the counterculture movement, creates this whole idea of there's a newfound respect, a new sort of fetishization of Native Americanness. And we can see this in all kinds of ways. Native people are all of a sudden popular. You see it in film with, new sympathetic depictions of Native people in films like A Man Called Horse and Little Big Man and Billy Jack and, a number of films that are these sympathetic treatments of Native people, and popular culture runs with it. And it is embedded all throughout the counterculture. The counterculture movement then starts to morph into the New Age movement in the 80s. And so now there's this whole new form of commodification of Native culture. And so like the floodgates are open. And there's whole other connections here about why California is such a magnet for all this stuff, having to do with California being like California bohemianism. California is a place where people come to remake themselves, reimagine themselves, a place to hide out, a place to become a different person. And so there's other things that we can talk about that answer that question about why does this happen. There's, in the ethnic pride movement, we start to see people like sloughing off whiteness, right? Or in this case, settlerness, like disavowing this very violent, the need to disavow this very violent American history.
And in general, whiteness is a call to strip oneself of one's identity and reduce it to a color, white, right?
Yeah. But it's not just whiteness that people are disavowing when it comes to Native American Indianness. As the example of Sasheen Littlefeather clearly shows, she was not white. She was half white. Okay, her mother was European, but her father was Mexican. He was Mexican. And to hear her sisters, who I interviewed extensively, talk about this family history, Sasheen was embarrassed to be Mexican. She hated being Mexican. Those are the words that her sisters used to me. And so for her, it was this need to move away from that Mexicanness. Well, she had the sort of like this gene pool, like phenotypical. She could pass. She had a look that could be convincing. It could be deployed in a way that was very easy to fool the American public if she did it right. She grew her hair long. She had long, straight black hair. She had features that people associate stereotypically with nativeness. And she played to it. And she used it for years and years and years. And so there's these, again, these really complicated dynamics that are taking place in American history that are very difficult relationships with settler colonialism and capitalism.
And I'm also wondering if we can move on to the topic of Buffy St. Marie. It wasn't just Sasheen Littlefeather. And of course, there have been many, many, many prominent people and not so prominent people who have been sort of outed as having adopted a mantle of being Native American, even if they've had no connection to it. Buffy St. Marie, very, very important figure, has long been seen as someone who really helped to raise the profile of Indigenous people, particularly in music, rock and roll. I remember interviewing her at KPFK Pacifica Radio years ago and being just floored by the honor of speaking with her. And it turns out that she too is someone who...
So heartbreaking.
Yeah. So let's talk about Buffy St. Marie. And then using that, Dina, can you comment on the fact that in spite of the fact that folks like Sasheen Littlefeather and Buffy St. Marie faked it, still in some strange way contributed to an effort to raise up the profile of Native Americans? Or maybe they didn't. I mean, how do you feel about that? And how is that seen? Is that something that's a topic of discussion among communities?
It always has been. I mean, stories that you hear from people are, I don't know, I would call an excuse, like, oh, well, it's okay because they did so much good, right? That was always applied to Iron Eyes Cody, also. Well, there was like a blind eye, Indian country in Hollywood turned a blind eye to the fact, it was like an open secret that he was a fraud too. But he donated a lot of money. He was a true ally to Indian country, and they valued that. So it's like this unspoken pact or something, I guess. Like, but we'll accept that help, and in turn we'll just ignore. We'll ignore what's right in front of our eyes, that you're not who you say you are. With Sasheen Littlefeather, that's always been floated as a reason to ignore. Or to deny the fact that she lied about who she was, because she supposedly did so much good work. I argue that I don't think I want to know, well, what is the good work that she did in Indian country? Show me, what did she actually do? I mean, even in her film roles, which were not very many, she actually, I think, caused harm because some of the roles that she played perpetuated really harmful stereotypes about Native women and violence against Native women. She, in one role, played a hooker in this film called Il Consigliore. It was an Italian film. In another film she played that was called Johnny Firecloud, there's a horrible scene where she plays a Native American teacher who gets brutally raped in a classroom. And it's very graphic. I mean, very graphic. And I never even knew about it until when I was doing the research, I found out that there's that rape scene still gets circulated on porn sites.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's shocking. Like, wait a minute, I thought she was the proud Native woman who was fighting against horrible stereotypes about Native women. How does that do that? How did that role do that? How did she justify that one? So like there's those things, but also just the fact that she just lied about everything. The thing about Sasheen was that she was mentally ill, okay? She was she's diagnosed schizoaffective disorder. And we can, that can go to a certain extent to describe this pathology of her continuing to insist that she was Native American. First she said Apache, then she said Yaqui. There's absolutely no evidence for any of them. Some people will argue that there was maybe some evidence of her that there's Yaqui heritage going back to Sonora. That's debatable. And that's a conversation for another time. But what I do know is it's not something that she knew of. She had no knowledge of any of that. She plucked it out of thin air. I think it's a conversation that you hear in Mexican communities a lot. There is, there are legitimate, connections of many Mexican people to Yaquis below the in Mexico.
Sure, yes, of course, there's a huge indigenous heritage within Mexico, right?
Yes. But she had none of that. She always started out claiming she was Apache, which there is absolutely no evidence for that. And the sisters will tell you that. But so she, some of this we can attribute to her mental illness, except the fact that she, for many years, she changed her stories and she also changed legal documents to support her claims. So there, that shows an intentionality. With Buffy, Buffy did do really good things. She helped the cause a lot. And that's what makes this one so devastating, that she was so, if we believe the investigation that was done on her by Jackie Keeler and later the show The Fifth Estate, that Canadian investigative show that exposed all of this. Of course that happens, and then Buffy retires. She just retires and she disappears. Now she's not in the limelight anymore. I mean, are these coincidences? I think not. I think that she got had. And there's absolutely no way that there's any evidence that she is who she said she is, as a Piapat Cree person, a person who was born in Canada to a native family and taken through the 60s scoop. None of it adds up. And I think it's not even debatable anymore whether or not that's true. And
Right. She was
people,
apparently born in Massachusetts.
she was born in Massachusetts. The birth certificate was found in the county where she was born. So,
So, Dina,
it's
in the
to an
last.
Italian family. People like this give Italians a bad name. I mean, I'm half Italian, right?
Right.
Ironized Cody was Sicilian, right? And I'm Sicilian. And I'm like, why is it that the Sicilians that are, come up so often in these fraud stories? It's very embarrassing.
Well, finally, let's wrap up the conversation to talk about how the process of writing this book and exploring these issues that are very complex, that are very necessarily tied to the origins of the United States as a settler colonial state, how that applies to what we're seeing today, where we are in the throes of a white supremacist resurgence that's very overt. And of course, that never went away, but it's really raging now. And what the research that you did and the writing of this book that you did, how it can illuminate the conversations around identity that we're seeing today. I'm just thinking of, for example, when Bad Bunny was picked to be the NFL halftime performer, and you had all these Turning Point USA's decided that they were going to have their own private performance of somebody who was Christian and American. And of course, Bad Bunny is both Christian and American, because they just didn't want to come out and say white. And so whiteness as this identity that white supremacists are holding on to. Any thoughts, any reflections on that as it relates to your book?
Oh my God. I keep thinking about the parallels and I mean, I don't even know where to begin, but it's like the hypocrisy. The hypocrisy is just off the charts. The hypocrisy of white supremacy is always self-evident. And Americanness has always been an identity crisis, and that's how folks like Philip DeLoria, who is one of my models for the book that I wrote, what you know, and he because he wrote this book called Playing Indian, and he made those connections a long time ago about how Americans were never fully comfortable with who they were. They came from somewhere else. They were Europeans. They came to this land, and they needed to somehow become Americans in a way that was authentic and legitimate. But they were always on the land illegitimately. To this day, I would argue that they're still on this land illegitimately through processes of profound violence while they were saying this is a land of freedom and liberty and justice for all, which has always been a qualified statement. It was always at the expense of Native people, and it still is. But you'll never hear it from them in those terms. Like, the best that you'll ever get is like, well, maybe there was some injustice, maybe there was mistreatment, these very benign terms. In the best of spaces, well, in some progressive spaces, we get more and more people saying that, yes, what happened here was wrong and it was a genocide. But when it comes to these right wing spaces, there's still these defenses of, and narratives of white European superiority. Like, that's what white supremacy is, the defending of Europeanness, whiteness. In a way that is that elevates them above all other kinds of human beings. That's really the foundation of this country. It's never changed. Yes, we're multicultural, but this thread of white European supremacy has never gone away. And and we're seeing it now. Yes, it's resurging, and it's blatant. It's in your face with some of these militia movements, these white supremacy groups, and Nazism, it's all there, and right. you can't deny it. So I'm thinking about this a lot, like, what are the parallels? And because I think pretendianism, this problem of ethnic fraud, is for Indian country what Trump and MAGAism is for the rest of the country. It's just this blatant hypocrisy, this blatant just fraud in your face all the time.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Dina Gilio-Whitaker. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dina Gilio-Whitaker of Colville Confederated Tribes. She's a lecturer of American Indian Studies at Cal State University, San Marcos. And we've been discussing her new book, Who Gets to Be Indian? Ethnic Fraud and Other Difficult Conversations About Native American Identity. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The United States prison system is one of the harshest and most punitive in the world, locking up nearly 2 million people. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, quote, the U.S. locks up more people per capita than any other independent democracy at the staggering rate of 580 per 100,000 residents. What's the point of such a high rate of incarceration? Rehabilitation, we are told, is the goal. Imprisoning people who are convicted of crimes will help them change their ways. But does this work? Are there even mechanisms in place to measure if it's working? Or are we merely locking people up and throwing away the key? What about those people who are sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole? The Federal Bureau of Prisons reports that inmates who participate in correctional education programs have 43% lower odds of returning to prison than those who do not, and that every dollar spent on prison education serves $4 to $5 on the costs of reincarceration. But prisons are constantly starving for funds. My next guest has direct experience with the false promise of rehabilitation in prisons. Dortell Williams is serving a life sentence without parole at Mule Creek State Prison. He's a regular correspondent on this program and also an essayist, and a campaign to help commute his sentence can be found at freedortellwilliams.com. Welcome back to the program, Dortell Williams.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning to you and your audience. I'm glad to be with you.
So you and I have talked so much about prisons and what they do, what they don't do. We are going to be talking today about rehabilitation, which often isn't the words that are used to describe prisons. They're labeled institutions that rehabilitate. In other words, help reform individuals who have been convicted of crimes. What does rehabilitation mean in the context of prisons? Like, how do prisons actually say they rehabilitate people?
Well, you know, it's an elusive word. And I would say for people with life sentences, me included, the board is probably the best measurement of rehabilitation as far as the state's definition of it. And that is to show that you're not a present danger to society when they release you. And then further than that, just in general, if a person were to get out and stay out for 3 years without going back to prison, they would consider that rehabilitated.
So for people who don't have access to parole or being able to go before a parole board, what does that mean? I mean, you have a life sentence without the possibility of parole. So how does someone in your position get treated by the system?
Well, to be blunt, we don't exist. We just don't exist. There's no measurement for us. There's no mechanism for us to be measured, to go to the board. We're just labeled incorrigible from the moment we're sentenced. And most of us are sentenced as emerging adults. So that means that we're between the ages of 18 and 25, which is generally the ages that people go to prison. But we are we're deemed incorrigible from the beginning, and that's it. So, that's how they would measure that.
And so what does that actually then mean in terms of rehabilitation for people who are incarcerated? How do prisons actually end up functioning if they're not really rehabilitating, especially if they're completely ignoring a whole class of people like yourself?
Well, so here's the interesting thing. There's always cracks, right? And so there have been many people who have been commuted. People get out because of the courts and that type of thing. And most of them, especially those with life sentences, they get out and they thrive. So even those who were deemed incorrigible 20 and 30 years ago, and they were able to get out through commutation or something like that, they've kind of proven that, that the label doesn't stick, right? I know some people that are running organizations themselves. I know some that do volunteer work. Just really extraordinary stories about post-release after life without or even life sentences. What I like most is comparisons, right? Because I think comparisons really tell the story. And so, like, in other countries like Norway and Germany, they have counselors, and the primary goal is more than just a label of corrections and rehabilitation. It's more than just a label. It's the actual promise and function. And so in Norway and Germany and the other places where rehabilitation is really the focus, security is a major dynamic. But in the forefront of that is counseling. And so they counsel people and give them treatment plans when they first come in to decide what exactly went wrong in their lives, how can they get back on track, and they give them the supports to do that during the time that they're in. We don't have anything near to that in here in America, and unfortunately there are a lot of people who are actually rehabilitated, but they're not deemed rehabilitated or recognized as rehabilitated, so they remain in prison.
What does that counseling do potentially? You and I have talked in the past about extensively about trauma and how people who, you know, end up entangled in the criminal justice systems are often reenacting cycles of trauma. Does counseling, or, you know, can counseling help to address that, help people reflect on their lives, help them maybe see themselves in the bigger system and help them really actually do the healing work that is rehabilitation?
Absolutely. And I think that's where you find a lot of the lifers. And just to put numbers on it, so people, there's two sets of people in prison for the most part, and those are the people who are in for a certain amount of time. They call them determinate sentences. So they're in for a determinate amount of time, and they automatically get out. Whether they rehabilitate or not, their time expires and they go home. And so some of them, unless they're internally motivated, they just do their time and go home. They might not have changed. They might, you know, they may actually be a risk for recidivism, but they're allowed to test outside in society, and, you know, we find out one way or the other. For those who are lifers, they're expected to, or we're expected to, better ourselves, read books, go to classes, and for the most part, we do that among ourselves. So, for instance, some friends of mine, we created a group called Men for Honor, and we ran like 19 different cognitive behavioral classes. And so what we were doing, we were teaching ourselves from curriculums from college, from books, wherever we could get knowledge and better ourselves. It was kind of like a each one teach one type thing. And, you know, that actually goes all the way back to times of Malcolm X. I like to bring Malcolm X because I think he's a really good case study. He had a mentor. He was just like so many of us. You know, he was trained in the streets. He, you know, he dealt with a lot of trauma and was misguided. And so he ended up going to prison. And while he was in prison, he was continued to be misguided until he found someone who was older and was willing to mentor him and guide him in the right direction. And as a result of that mentoring, we got the Malcolm X that we later saw, you know, being a phenomenal speaker and so on and so forth. And as a metaphor, kind of, there's a lot of Malcolm X's in here who mentor youth and get them on track. And for the benefit for us is that we're creating a stable and harmonious environment if we have to be here. If that makes sense.
Now, what you were describing in terms of doing the work yourselves, if this is work that you're doing in a voluntary way, it doesn't have to be done in prison, right? Why is it that there are so many folks like yourself who are being kept behind bars, who are doing the work because the state isn't doing it for them, who could be doing it while also having freedom, who could be getting the resources, because it sounds like you're doing it without necessarily too many resources, if any, from the outside. But we could resource people. We could actually enable them to enjoy their freedom while they're rehabilitating themselves or getting the help that they need.
Right. And we are beginning to see more of that. Some of the lifers are now being allowed to come in. And basically what the system is doing now is it's outsourcing people who are formerly incarcerated, which that's a good thing. They're more open to allowing people to come in who have been formerly incarcerated to teach us what they've learned and how they've succeeded. And then there are a lot of volunteers who come in, and some of those volunteers are the jumpstart. Like for me, I had taken a parenting class. And in the parenting class, I saw that the way I was raised and the things that were going on in my house were not really normal, domestic violence type stuff that, you know, and I don't hold my parents, especially my dad, accountable for that. He was doing the best he could at the time. But that was what showed me that I had some work to do. And it's been a phenomenal journey since. So the parenting classes were a phenomenal help. They jump-started my journey toward transformation, and it was really a model of how to teach one another, how to teach what we can learn. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the staff, the officers, come from some of the same traumatized environments and communities that we come from. So, you know, there's that continuum of belittling and, you know, behavior that's really not, for lack of a better way of saying it, you know, professional. Not all the officers are like that, but there's enough to continue the harm, right? And so we learn, we're teaching ourselves and reading books about trauma and learning the correct ways of treating one another, which is like a given in Germany, that those are the types of training that they go through. It's not all just against force and violence and that type of thing, but they actually are trained in trauma-informed care. And, and as a matter of fact, we've heard a lot about this California model, and the state is trying to go that way. There's a lot of resistance. But in the meantime, this is how we support one another. We support one another by finding constructive ways to do our time, trying to show amends, trying to show remorse, and recognizing that, you know, we've made some bad decisions and we need to fix ourselves, right?
Dortel, how, you know, does prison end up making it harder for people to actually rehabilitate themselves if they understand that that's a necessary step to ensuring that they live a happy life and don't harm others? Does prison end up making it harder, sort of undermining its own stated goal?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you asked that question. There are several obstacles toward us trying to rehabilitate ourselves or get the rehabilitative needs that we have. One of those is the structure. The very structure of prison has always been punishment, and so there's solitary confinement and what they called we call it the SHU, but they call it security housing unit. And there's a lot of places for that because it was all designed to be punishment. But there's not a lot of places, I mean, physical space for classroom teaching, for gathering, for meeting together. There's not a lot of space for that. So it's very limited, the spaces where we can meet and actually support one another and have those safe spaces to talk about, anything from sexual violence to domestic violence, whatever the case may be. We can do those in safe spaces, but there's just not a lot of room for it. So that's a problem. And then another problem is the prisons continue to be overcrowded. And so the waiting list for anything from GED, which I have seen list as long as 9 years for a person just to get into GED, and which is a requirement for parole eligibility, that's a problem. And then, trying to get access to the volunteers that come in to teach us things like domestic violence, family relationships, math and tutoring, trauma, any of those different things. There's just always such a limit for our capacity to grow.
If you could design a system where rehabilitation was central, where it was the centerpiece of understanding of enabling individuals who've been caught up in a cycle of harm to get to break out of it, what would it look like? And, you know, be as radical as you can be, including envisioning a world without prisons.
Okay, well, let's just say we have three levels, right? We have the reality that we have today, and it's not working. It's really not working. And I say that because we have passed law after law. We just passed Prop 36 here in California, and people are still doing smash and grabs. Prisons don't really work to that degree, and they certainly don't prevent crime. Then we have, the more medium approach, which is what California is trying to do now with the California model, and trying to emulate what they have over in Norway, which is a system that is geared more toward helping us and not punishing us and getting us on the road to rehabilitation. That's very questionable. I always question, can we really, really rehabilitate someone in a cage, right? We're dehumanizing and humanizing at the same time. It doesn't work. And then if you ask for radical, in my opinion, as a trauma practitioner, and knowing the statistics that 80 to 90% of us, or 70 to 80% of us, come to prison with at least four ACEs or adverse childhood experiences, I would say that, and there's plenty of evidence about this, chaining people, confining people, that's all traumatic. So it just adds to the fire, right? I think that we should be addressing people's individual needs from a trauma-informed approach, and helping them rehabilitate and co-rehabilitate themselves. In other words, with a psychiatrist or a doctor or whatever it is that they need, because most of us actually come in with some type of a mental health issue, whether it's distorted thinking, which is a lot of us, you know, that's the case for a lot of us, to extreme cases like psychosis. But if we really, really wanted to get to the bottom of harm and the reasons why people cause harm, we have to look at it from a traumatic approach.
Well, then finally, Dortal, why do you think, what stands in the way of making the system work better? You know, the current system, as you said, doesn't work. There are so many models, ideas. Even if we didn't go to a model that you suggest, but went, say, even halfway to Germany's model, what's stopping U.S. prisons and the prison system from achieving that?
Well, I think there's two dynamics at play. And one is educating the public about the realities of prison, the realities of the causes of crime, and the success models that are out there. And I think, you know, the media gets in the way, because the media often distorts the bigger picture. They don't go into the details that are needed. And you hardly ever hear about these types of success stories that I mentioned earlier on the news. So that's one problem, is that we're not educating people properly and adequately. Second, you know, here in America, there's always been different agendas. And the elite, you know, tend to have their agenda, and then there's the rest of us, right? And unfortunately, some people profit off of these current mechanisms that are in place. They profit from them. The apparatus that I'm on right now, they exploit us with paid emails when the emails are free on the outside. And I could just go on and on and on about the exploitation there. From voting to financial incentives. But, I think we have those two dynamics at play. There's an incentive to actually lock people up, because if you build the beds, you have to fill them, right? Mm-hmm. And then second, our populace is not really informed about how prisons work, the needs for prison, the agendas behind the prisons. And so, with that said, I'm really glad that you have your own audience, and that people are willing to hear an alternative. But that is really one of the core problems.
I want to thank you, as always, Dortal, for joining us and sharing your insights with our audiences.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for your listeners for being open to alternative voices, and especially from someone who's inside. Thank you.
My guest has been Dortal Williams, serving a life sentence without parole at Mule Creek State Prison. He's a regular correspondent on this show. And for full disclosure, I'm a member of the committee to free Dortal Williams. And you can find out more about efforts by his allies and supporters to commute his sentence at freedortalwilliams.com. That's freedortalwilliams, D-O-R-T-E-L-L, williams.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media, more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want